Dear ladies and gentlemen, it's a great pleasure for me to welcome here with us Professor Wilfried Mullens, who is based in Genk, Belgium. Wilfried Mullens is a heart failure specialist. He is an ESC Heart Failure Association board member, and he's also a main author of the renowned EDVOR trial study, which was published 2 years ago. Professor Mullens, he kindly accepted our invitation for a presentation aiming on decongestion therapy in acute heart failure patients. Thank you very much for joining a webinar from Czech Acute Association. Thank you very much again.
Well, good evening, everybody, dear colleagues. Thank you for the invitation. It's more an honor to give this talk to a lot of acute cardiologists, which is very important, of course. I think we were in Czechia last year. I met Alice Linhardt, and Alice and I organized the HFA meeting in Prague, which was very successful. I mean, I think everybody enjoyed not only the meeting, but also the country. So everybody was extremely happy with the meeting that we had in Prague. So first of all, I think it's important that we all recognize that congestion is really an important feature of heart failure patients associated with worse outcomes. In the Entresto trial, the risk for patients to die or to be hospitalized was 20% at 2 years if they were ambulatory. And if you're hospitalized and you're discharged with ongoing congestion, the risk goes up to 60% at 1 year. Congestion is more important than low cardiac outputs, and this has been proven on the left side by Greg Fonerow more than 20 years ago, where he showed that an increase in filling pressures was extremely important with regards to outcomes. Now, if you look at the kidney gets about 1 liter of blood every minute. So it's not a surprise that central hemodynamics also play a role in normal kidney function. We and others have shown that an increased central venous pressure is more important than a low cardiac output to actually predict who's going to have worsening renal function. This is kind of a paradigm shift in the way cardiologists are treating heart failure, that it's more important to treat congestion than it is to treat low cardiac output. If you look at the kidney, again, you're born with about 1 million nephrons. We lose nephrons every year once we're aged. So it's extremely important that we try to stop the decline of kidney function. So the green line is a normal GFR deterioration, which is about 1 ml per year if you reach the age of 50. If you have heart failure, this is accelerated to about 2.5 mLs per year, and that is why we emphasize to put patients with heart failure on sacubitril valsartan and SGLT2 inhibitors, because these are the only drugs that can lower down this decline in GFR. We also recommend in our guidelines that we have to exclude congestion. We have to treat congestion very aggressively before we discharge patients back home. Now, if you look at congestion a little bit more physiologically, there are four important mechanisms. First of all, you have to realize that we absorb all the sodium that we eat. You cannot lose sodium in your gut. That's just because we are human beings and we are standing upright. So we have a very high RAS activity. Therefore, you cannot lose sodium in your gut. If you would eat one bag of potato chips every day, yes, you'll see you have an increased natriuresis. So you pee out more sodium. However, if you have mild heart failure, even before you're symptomatic, you're not able to excrete all that sodium. What is also important is that even if you're normal, you will have a positive sodium balance after a couple of days. This means that the problem of heart failure doesn't stop with the kidney, but it starts with the kidney. It also means that there are sodium stores. We can all store sodium that we are eating that we don't need in stores which are in the skin, bone, cartilage, and these stores can buffer sodium, keep it away from water, and you take the sodium out of these stores whenever you need it. And I think we have to do a lot more investigation into these stores, because this might be a mechanism to treat heart failure and hypertension better in the future. Now, what happens with sodium in the kidney? Well, we filter a lot of water and sodium in the kidney. You filter, if you have a normal GFR, around 1 kilogram of sodium every day. Most physicians believe that the problem is that we all have reduced GFR if we have heart failure, and therefore we cannot lose enough sodium. But this is not correct, because even if you have a GFR of 10 mLs per minute, which is really low, you still filter around 150 grams sodium per day. If you eat around 4 grams of sodium daily in the Czech Republic, it means that you still are able to filter enough in order to be in balance. So the filtration is not the problem, but the problem is that we reabsorb most of the sodium which we have filtered. And therefore, you have to understand a little bit of kidney physiology. And those are the four most difficult slides I will show you within the next 20 minutes. So we'll go over the glomerulus first. The glomerulus, that's the site where all the filtration actually occurs. So blood comes to the kidney via the afferent arteriole. Then you have capillaries. And then blood leaves the glomerulus via the efferent arteriole. So you have two arterioles in series. The GFR is determined by the squeezing of the afferent and the efferent arteriole. If you have heart failure, you have a reduced renal blood flow. And in order to maintain a GFR of 100 mL per minute, because that's what the kidney wants to preserve a normal GFR. So in order to do that, if you have a lower renal blood flow, you'll have vasoconstriction on the efferent side and vasodilatation on the afferent side. This dramatically changes the filtration fraction. And the filtration fraction is the ratio of GFR divided by renal blood flow. So if you keep the GFR stable and you reduce renal blood flow, you increase the filtration fraction. This means that more water and more sodium is filtered according to what is going to the kidney. But this will change the content of the proteins in the blood leaving the glomerulus, and that blood will go next to the tubules in the peritubular capillaries. So you see an increased oncotic pressure if you have heart failure, and this will promote proximal sodium reabsorption. And this is the problem in heart failure and in CKD, that you have an increased sodium reabsorption in the proximal parts of the kidney. If you look a little bit more distal at the loop of Henle at the macula densa level, the macula densa senses the amount of chloride which is actually running in the tubules. If you have absorbed more sodium and chloride proximal, you have less chloride here, and this will lead to the release of renin, which is, of course, a bad thing. The distal tubal, if you have not enough sodium here, you have more aldosterone, more BMP, which will further promote sodium reabsorption. The third problem is that it's very difficult for our bodies to lose sodium, but it's pretty easy to lose water. This is because if you drink water, you change osmolarity, and osmolarity changes are not tolerated by the body, because then your brain will swell. But sodium excretion is extremely difficult, especially if you have heart failure. And the fourth mechanism is very important as well. You need water enabled to excrete sodium, because normally your urinary sodium is lower than your serum sodium if you use diuretic therapy. So if you have a serum sodium of 140, you can never lose isotonic urine. So you need to drink water enabled to excrete sodium. So putting people on water restriction if they have heart failure is probably not a bad, it's not a good idea, because then you can never lose sodium. Now, how to treat the problem of congestion? We put in the guidelines that loop diuretics have a class 1 recommendation to treat signs and symptoms of congestion in every ejection fraction category, HFrEF, HFmrEF, and HFpEF. Now, if you look at the trial which examined in a double-blind randomized fashion loop diuretic therapy, that's the DOSE trial. And those compared a low dose furosemide versus a high dose, continuous versus bolus infusion. So four different treatment strategies. If you look at their endpoint of heart failure hospitalization and mortality, this was pretty bad, because 50% of the patients were actually dead or rehospitalized after 2 months. There was no difference amongst the treatment groups. Freedom from congestion, so that means is your patient dry after 3 days? Only 15% of the patients included in those was dry after 3 days of only loop diuretic therapy. This means that if you give only loop diuretic therapy, the chances are not so high that you will get your patients dry. And if you send them home wet, they will have a high likelihood that they will die or be rehospitalized again. Why is loop diuretic therapy as a monotherapy so often ineffective? It is because you don't have a normal diuretic response if you are already on a loop diuretic at home. Normally, you should pee around 3 liters of water and sodium if you give 40 milligrams of furosemide, but this only happens to a patient which is loop diuretic naive. It does not happen to a patient who was already on loop diuretics. The second problem with loop diuretic therapy is if you look over consecutive days at the urinary output per milligram furosemide, you see that it's more or less stable. But the sodium content is dramatically dropping. So that means that every day, if you give consecutive days of loop diuretic therapy, that the amount of sodium in the urine is dropping. So the quality of the urine is dropping if you only give loop diuretic therapy. There might be some future in subcutaneous furosemide. There is an American and a UK study which looked at the efficacy of sub-Q furosemide in patients at home. And this might be a solution to prevent hospitalizations, but still it's only loop diuretic therapy and it's going to be very expensive. In order to improve the utilization of loop diuretic therapy, we wrote with HFA this position statement about diuretic therapy a couple of years ago. And this position statement has a lot of very practical flowcharts and very important rules. The first rule is door to diuretic time. There is no need to wait to give IV diuretic therapy to a patient with heart failure, because the longer you wait, the less the likelihood will be that that patient will be treated appropriately. The second rule is that you have to evaluate the effect of the loop diuretic as soon as you give the diuretic. Diuretics work for 4 to 6 hours, so you have to evaluate the effect of the loop diuretic therapy. How can you do that? Either you measure urinary volume, which should be at least 100 cc's per hour, but that's not easy to do, because measuring urinary output is not easy. It's far easier to measure the urinary sodium content. So you give the IV furosemide and you put in an order that your nurse takes the first urinary sample, sends it to the lab, and then that should be at least 70 mg per liter. If the urinary sodium content is less than 70 mg per liter, you have to double the amount of loop diuretic therapy already 6 hours later. This has been incorporated now in the guidelines to actually be to be used as a way to use loop diuretic therapy better. There are 4 prospective trials looking at the effect of desalination using this natriuresis guided approach. 2 of them have been published. It was the ENACT study and the PUSH AF study. There was also one center in the Czech Republic that was actually including patients in the ENACT study. Also, they showed an impressive increase in natriuresis if you guide your diuretic therapy according to the urinary sodium that you measure, which the patient is actually producing. Another very frequent problem is worsening renal function while you're giving loop diuretic therapy. What do you do if you see that your serum creatinine goes up or your GFR goes down while you're giving diuretic therapy? The first thing to do is to assess the diuretic response, because if you have a good diuretic response, you shouldn't worry, and you should just continue your decongestive efforts as you were doing. So, looking at worsening renal function without having insights in the diuretic response is not a good thing. You need to know if the patient is responding to the diuretic therapy. And if he's responding well, you just continue your decongestive efforts. If, however, he's not responding well, you have to make sure there is no hyperperfusion. Hyperperfusion means shock, which is extremely rare, and in those patients, you should be giving inotropic agents or consider mechanical circulatory support. Most often, however, they do not have hyperperfusion, but you just have to increase your diuretic intensity or you consider the utilization of IV vasodilators. Which are the second-line diuretic agents? You first might consider spironolactone. There has been one trial which compared 25 milligrams of spironolactone, which was usual care, with 100 milligrams. And there was absolutely no benefit of using a higher dose to actually increase the diuretic response. So spironolactone is very important, but it will not help you to decongest patients better if you increase the dose. So you should not increase the dose unless you have hypokalemia. What about thiazides? Thiazides have a class 2A recommendation to be used in patients with congestion. There is one trial now, which it was a prospective double-blind trial done in Spain with the utilization of hydrochlorothiazide on top of furosemide versus placebo. The investigators gave 100 milligram of hydrochlorothiazide in patients with a low GFR, and they gave 25 milligrams in patients with a high GFR. Their primary endpoint was a change in weight and a symptom improvement, and they saw a little bit increase in weight loss if they combined furosemide with hydrochlorothiazide. So you see 800 grams more weight reduction, which is significant, but not that much. What is really important was their sub-analysis looking at the effect of adding hydrochlorothiazides according to GFR. And there you see a problem because the patients with a low GFR did not have any benefit of adding a thiazide. This is problematic, because the patients who are diuretic resistant also have a low GFR. And despite the fact that the investigators used a very high dose of a thiazide, there was absolutely zero benefit of adding the thiazides to high doses of furosemide. You also have to bear in mind that thiazides are not innocent drugs. If in a large prospective corrected analysis, they have shown to be linked with an increased risk for mortality. One of the reasons for that is their high risk for hypokalemia. In the chlorotic trial, 50% of the patients developed significant hypokalemia, defined as a potassium level below 3. So giving a thiazide is only to be done temporarily while you monitor potassium levels very closely, because they are linked with an increased mortality. If you look at the nephron, and we went over loop diuretics, thiazides, MRAs, all these drugs work distal from the part where most sodium reabsorption occurs, which is in the proximal part of the kidney. So why don't we focus our attention to the proximal part of the kidney? Of course, the drug that everybody's talking about is SGLT2 inhibition. because there you block glucose uptake in the proximal part of the kidney, and therefore you have an osmotic diuresis. SGLT2 inhibition does increase acutely diuresis, but it does not increase natriuresis. So you increase diuresis, but you will not get more sodium out. In contrast, there is another agent which is called acetazolamide, and this blocks carbon anhydrase. Therefore, you interfere with the sodium proton exchanger in the proximal parts of the kidney, and you double the amount of sodium excretion if you combine that with furosemide. And this was the reasoning for the ETFOR trial. So ETFOR was a pragmatic, prospective, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled trial done in Belgium. It was very simple. We actually included patients with congestion and volume overload, and we randomized them to twice the home dose of loop diuretics plus placebo versus twice the home dose of loop diuretics plus once daily, 500 milligrams of acetazolamide, so on top of a standardized IV loop diuretic therapy, and this for 3 days. We asked the investigators to look at the congestion score, and this is the reason why we give diuretic therapy. Is there edema? Is there pleural effusion? And is there ascites? And if there's no edema, no pleural effusion, and no ascites, there is, in my account, no reason to give loop diuretic therapy. So the primary endpoint was, is your patient dry? So meaning no edema, no pleural effusion, and no ascites after 3 days. When we looked at our trial compared with the other trials, which I just discussed, you see that patients in ETFOR were considerably older, they were 78, more were on MRAs, and their NT-proBNPs were 6,000. So these were old, frail patients with a lot of CKD on good medical therapy. These are exactly the patients that you see daily flooding your emergency room departments with congestion. So this was really a pragmatic trial. The primary endpoint was, is your patient dry after 3 days of diuretic therapy? And you see a 60% increase in the number of patients being dry after 3 days of diuretic therapy. This was independent of any other factor, age, ejection fraction, NT-proBNP, sex, GFR. It was all favorably affected by acetazolamide. Many of you might not use the drug because they think, you know, I don't need it. I can get my patients dry without acetazolamide. So we also assessed the amount of patients that was dry at discharge. But even there, we saw a spectacular improvement in the patients that received upfront acetazolamide. Almost 80% was dry, while there was only 60% dry in the placebo arm. Why is that? Well, it is because there was an incremental benefit of adding acetazolamide upfront. What you actually do when you give this drug, you actually prevent loop diuretic resistance from occurring. If you add acetazolamide, you prevent that your patient will become loop diuretic resistant. And this is actually shown by this sub-analysis, which actually shows that the patients who have most loop diuretic resistance, which are the ones with the highest bicarbonate levels, actually have the most benefit of adding acetazolamide. There was also a reduction in length of stay, and there was no increased risk for any renal adverse events or any hypotension. We didn't see that with the use of the drug. We published the trial in the New England Journal of Medicine, so we were very happy with this. So this is the way we're looking currently to use diuretic therapy. We use spot natriuresis as a safe, reliable, inexpensive, implementable marker to assess the response and to guide diuretic therapy. So we use the first 3 days a natriuresis-based loop diuretic dosing. We switch our patients to oral loop diuretics once they are dry, and we try to discharge them with the lowest amount of loop diuretics possible. We give ezetazolamide to everybody who was already on a loop diuretic when they entered the hospital for 3 to 5 days, once daily. We add an SGLT2 to everybody, and we continue that lifelong because SGLT2 inhibitions are chronic agents to be given chronically to prevent bad outcomes. And we try to uptitrate neuro-hormonal blockers to, of course, improve outcomes on the long run. I think I'm going to stop here, but I'm open for any question you might still have.
Thank you very much, Wilfried, for this very detailed, nice presentation about an approach to congested patients. So, I would like to ask you. So, you've chosen for let's say quantification of congestion three variables: ascites, leg swelling, and pleural effusion. Why don't you initially choose also a lung congestion?
Because it was a it's a good question, of course, and many people are asking me the same type of question about this, because this was a pragmatic trial, and we didn't have the funding to also assess lung congestion. I think it would have been better as a hemodynamic measurement, so completely I agree with you. But this was a trial which was done in 26 centers in Belgium. We had very limited resources, budgets, and if we had to include lung ultrasound, not only would the trial have been more expensive, but it also would have been less pragmatic because a lot of physicians are not trained to do that. Although it's very easy, I admit that, but you don't always have a lung ultrasound or an ultrasound machine at hand, so the trial wouldn't have been possible to do it.
Sure. Maybe one more question. So, regarding the inclusion criteria, you have chosen, let's say, chronic heart failure patients who were admitted with, let's say, acute on chronic heart failure. These were not patients with cardiogenic shock. So, do you also administer or do you also offer acetazolamide to patients, for example, with low cardiac output and with cardiogenic shock? What do you think about this approach?
Absolutely. I mean, this is just an inclusion criterion that we used. To include a patient with cardiogenic shock would also have been difficult. So, but I don't see any reason physiologically why you would not add acetazolamide to a patient with cardiogenic shock on the condition, of course, that they have congestion. There basically is no real contraindication for acetazolamide. We included patients up to a down to a GFR of 20, so there is absolutely no safety risk if you would add it to a patient with cardiogenic shock.
And one of your sub-analysis documented that baseline bicarb level really matters, isn't it? So, would you still administer acetazolamide in patients with a low bicarb level, for example, 15 or 16? What do you think about this?
Yeah, it's also a question that comes back very frequently. No, most patients will have a high bicarbonate level when they enter the hospital, of course, because of the neurohormonal stimulation. I think we all look at the high bicarbonate levels as a contraction alkalosis phenomenon. But contraction alkalosis, that happens if you lose blood, for example. And the reason why you have that is because you have an increased neurohormonal stimulation, which promotes proximal bicarbonate retention. Heart failure patients do not have a contraction, but they also many times have an increased bicarbonate because of neurohormonal stimulation. And you hardly ever see a patient with a low bicarbonate level if they have heart failure. So first of all, I think it's more a theoretical concern because you don't see that in real life. And secondly, we've never ever seen a metabolic acidosis occurring while we're giving because of the acetazolamide. So I wouldn't worry about that as well.
Thank you. What's your personal approach? You are a young doctor on ICU who is admitting a patient who's congested. You gave him a dose of furosemide, which is usually for example, might be twice higher than its chronic dose. And then you just add acetylazolamide, 500 milligrams IV. So what do you prescribe to your nurse? What would you say here in terms of natriuresis measurement? Will you tell her?
What we do routinely is we order a urinary sodium analysis. So what we do very practically, we tell the nurse that the patient has to pee empty before we give the diuretic. Then you give the diuretic, just like you explained, intravenously, bolus, twice the home dose. We add 500 milligrams of acetazolamide, and we tell the nurse the first urine the patient produces, you take a sample, you send it to the lab, or we put the order in for urinary sodium content. It will come back after 20 minutes because it's a very easy analysis. If the urinary sodium content is below 70, then we have a protocol that the nurse will give double the amount of furosemide bolus 6 hours after the first initial dosing. And then you're almost always at the right spot. So if you give double the amount of furosemide with acetazolamide, there is 60 to 70% of the patients will already are above 70 mg per liter, but 30% are not. And in dose, it's extremely important that you increase the dose of the furosemide the next dose.
So irrespective of volume of the first urinary collection, it could be 50 milliliters, it could be 500 milliliters, you send it to the lab.
It tracks pretty well. So it tracks pretty well with urinary volume, especially the first day. Not so much the second day, but the first day, there's a pretty good correlation between urinary volume and urinary sodium content. But to measure urinary volume, unless they have a Foley catheter, is really difficult. I mean, because patients pee everywhere except in the bucket that you give them. They pee in their diapers, they pee in the toilet, they pee everywhere, but not in the... So if you can measure urinary volume, that's fine as well. And then it should be at least 100 cc's per hour. So if you don't reach the 100 cc per hour, you also have to double the amount. But urinary volume assessments is far more difficult than measuring urinary sodium content.
Perfect.
Most of our patients don't want a Foley catheter anymore. And most of them are very old. And they don't. Yeah, they're just incontinent, and they pee everywhere. But yeah, so it's very difficult to measure the volume.
You've also mentioned the importance of the effect of acetazolamide on natriuresis in the proximal tubule. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the chronic use of acetazolamide in heart failure patients?
Yeah, I don't recommend doing it because we don't have any safety data if you would give it orally for weeks and weeks. So we never do it orally. We never do it chronically orally. We sometimes give it orally for a couple of days. And there also are countries where they don't have access to the IV formularium. And there you can give the same dose orally for 3 to 5 days. And there it also will work in a similar fashion as you give it intravenously. But I would not give it chronically because then we don't know what's going to happen with the bicarbonate. So chronic use of acetazolamide is probably not to be recommended. Temporarily for a couple of days, yes, but not chronically.
Sounds reasonable. Thank you again. Thank you again for joining us. Maybe my last question would be, do you have any other randomized trial in the pipeline?
Yeah, so we're doing a randomized trial on how to implement medical therapy. So if any of you would like to join, you can just send us an email because it's also going to be an international pragmatic trial. And we're also looking at easier implementation of this natriuresis-based loop diuretic dosing. So we're working on sensors that your nurse can just put in the urine and then immediately she can read actually how much sodium is in the urine because that will facilitate using this natriuresis-based loop diuretic dosing. Yeah.
So let me congratulate you and thank you again for joining us today. See you later.
It's a pleasure. Bye-bye.
Tak děkujeme všem, kteří jste se dneska k nám připojili a uvidíme se zase za měsíc zde živě z Kavčích hor. Naschledanou.